The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. And a show in three parts, all dealing with aspects of heredity. Part one.
So we've been designing new amino acids that haven't been seen in nature and developing approaches that allow us to direct those amino acids into proteins.
In a paper published days ago, scientists have created the first organism to harbour and pass on an expanded genetic code. Professor Jason Chin, a leading researcher in synthetic biology, tells us where this kind of work is going. In part two, we look ahead to the Royal Society's Conference on Women in Science, Revealing Lives.
If a woman collaborates with a man, she tends to get put down as his assistant.
Dr. Claire Jones and Professor Tilly Tanzi describe some of the greatest contributions women have made to science but have so often been overlooked. Why future generations of women scientists need to celebrate this heritage. And in part three, we hear from the Nobel Prize-winning Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn on her own great contribution, the discovery and understanding of telomeres, the tail ends of chromosomes, and her somewhat controversial and short-lived role in US science policy. This is a bumper edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. For billions of years, the diversity of life has been encoded in just four letters, G, T, C and A. The chemicals that form the double helix of the DNA strand. But that era of life is now over. Researchers led by Floyd Romsberg, a chemical biologist at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California, have created the first organism that carries and passes on an expanded genetic alphabet. Their bugs have normal DNA plus two new chemical letters that add to the natural DNA sequence. To discuss the importance of the work and its implications for synthetic biology, I'm joined on the line by Jason Chin, Program Leader at the Medical Research Council's Laboratory of Molecular Biology here in the UK. Jason, thanks for joining us. What have Romsberg and his team done here?
Yeah, so in this latest paper from the Romsberg group, they've basically created new letters in the genetic alphabet. So normally in the DNA in the cells that contain the instructions for making the proteins that carry out the functions in cells, the DNA is written in a four-letter code using the DNA bases A, C, G, and T. And these are strung together in long sequences that make genes that encode the proteins that carry out functions in our body that we allow us to convert the food that we eat into fuel and to do all the things that we sort of associate with the mechanics of being alive. Fundamentally, what the Romsberg group has done is to show that in addition to these four letters A, C, G, and T that are normally in DNA, they can add another letter to DNA within another pair of letters, really, to DNA within a living cell.
And what is the significance of it being in a living cell? Does that really matter, or is that more of a sort of I don't want to belittle it, but is that more of a gimmick?
One of the things about cells is, of course, that cells contain the DNA. And that DNA is an instruction is a set of instructions for how to make a copy of itself. So through the process of cell division, a cell will make a copy of itself. And in the same way that, or in a similar way to the way that through a process of reproduction, the DNA of the parents gets in part copied to the offspring. So the significance of this being in a cell is that it really couples the additional letter in the additional pair of letters in the genetic code to the cell's ability to copy those letters and to actually inherit those new letters, not just in the cell that you've added them to, but to pass those letters on to the offspring of those cells, if you like, which fundamentally means that you're adding the capacity to pass on new information to the offspring.
Your own research group is really active in this area. What are you focusing on yourself?
So we've been focusing on the process by which cells make proteins. So DNA, if you like, provides the instructions for how to make proteins in cells. And proteins are the molecules that carry out many of the functions in cells. So really, it's the properties of the proteins themselves that we've been interested in developing. So in the same way that DNA is composed of a conservative set of four bases that are strung together in these long polymer chains that make genes, proteins are composed of 20 units called amino acids, and these 20 naturally occurring units are strung together in different combinations, much like beads on a necklace, if you like, with each amino acid being a different bead, and the way you arrange those beads on the necklace is ultimately controlled by the sequence of DNA in the cell, and the sequence of beads on the necklace ultimately controls the properties of the protein and what the protein does in the cell. And so we've been interested in developing approaches that allow us to expand the types of beads that you can put onto the necklace. So while biology uses 20 naturally occurring amino acids and strings those together to make proteins, we've been interested in developing approaches that allow us to put additional chemical entities into proteins, additional beads into the necklace that biology doesn't typically use.
So does that mean that you would essentially be almost designing amino acids that aren't seen in nature?
Exactly. So we've been designing new amino acids that haven't been seen in nature and developing approaches that allow us to direct those amino acids into proteins at particular positions, if you like, in this, to continue this necklace analogy, to put these new beads into new positions, into positions in the necklace, wherever we'd like to be able to place them.
Some people might look at this kind of story and think that the sort of diversity of life around us is pretty much coded into GTCNA, into that genetic code. And by expanding that genetic alphabet, people might wonder what you'll be creating from this kind of work. But what are your aims? Where are you? What do you hope to come of what you're doing?
So some of the types of things that our lab has been interested in are developing approaches that allow us to actually use these technologies that we're developing, both to understand biology better, to understand the natural mechanisms by which biology works, and to some extent the mechanisms by which biology goes wrong within the context of disease. And so, as I mentioned, proteins carry out many of the functions within cells, and the ability to put well-defined chemical entities into proteins in the form of these new amino acids that we chemically synthesize and introduce into proteins allows us to develop approaches to study what those proteins are doing within the context of cells in ways that would be very hard to do by, if you like, classical biological methods. And so one of our goals is really to develop a suite of approaches that allow us to really get deeper insight into how biology works. Another goal of the field is really to make actually more efficacious and better drugs, in this case, protein therapeutics. So I think there are approaches both in terms of, or things that we can learn and things that we can develop, both in terms of getting a deeper understanding of underlying biology, both natural biology for basic research and biology and disease, but also in terms of being able to make new types of molecules that will have the potential to directly impact on therapy.
Jason, before I let you go, Science Weekly is the new place for leading scientists to announce their big breakthroughs. Forget about nature and science and whatever. I'm just wondering, what is the next big breakthrough from your lab on this?
Okay, I'll tell you in 2 years.
A huge thanks to Jason Chin there. To read more on this story and on the latest breakthroughs in synthetic biology, just go to theguardian.com/science. One of the most important and recurrent themes amongst government policymakers, academic institutions, and the private sector is the need to get more young women into what's called STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And a conference to be held at the Royal Society in London this month poses the question, how can we enable women scientists of the future if we fail to celebrate their contributions to science in the past? Revealing Lives, Women in Science from 1830 to 2000 is the title of the conference, and I'm joined down the line by two key contributors, Dr. Claire Jones, a science historian from the University of Liverpool, and Professor Tilly Tansey, former neurochemist and professor of the history of modern medical science at Queen Mary University of London. Welcome to you both. Can I start with you, Claire? What was the catalyst for this conference?
Well, it's a conference that's part of a Women in Science Research Network, which is funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, the AHRC. So really what we wanted to do was draw together people from a very wide background. So we have historians and archivists, as well as practicing scientists, people from a social science background. And really what we want to do is to look at history and look at what we can learn from history and sort of the invisibility of women scientists in history, but to see if that can shed light on the situation today and questions that we ask about, you know, the low numbers of women in science today.
And you talk about the invisibility of women in science. I mean, why is that the case? Why has it been that way?
Well, it's interesting. There's always been assumptions about gender, I think, from way back. I think historically women tend to be forgotten. It's hard to find women in the archive, especially because many of them may have done their research not in an institutional setting, especially if you talk about, you know, the mid-19th century onwards, they may have done their research at home. I'm thinking about people like the physicist and electrical engineer Hertha Ayrton, or the biologist and pioneer filmmaker Rena Scott. So we don't find them in the archive. They tended not to be fellows of elite scientific institutions. As you know, the first women were elected to the Royal Society in 1945. But if you look at the period from 1880 to, say, 1914, there were so many women. Well, I say so many. It's careful not to get carried away. I've identified about 60 women who were publishing, working at the margins, getting the odd grant, and even getting the odd award from the Royal Society, but weren't actually members, you know, as fellows. And this is paralleled in other elite learned societies. So when people look to find the scientist of the time, they look in the records of somewhere like the Royal Society or the Royal Astronomical Society, and you don't tend to find the women. You have to look elsewhere to find them. Another reason is that they often collaborated. And if a woman collaborates with a man, she tends to get put down as his assistant. And this is a real problem in marriages. Where people collaborated together. There's lots of examples of that. For example, Margaret Huggins, the astronomer, who collaborated with her husband, William Huggins, who was a president of the Royal Society. And she was very much an equal partner, but she's been forgotten, for example.
So is this a simple case of, or a simple series of cases of sexism, of just belittling the female contribution?
No, I think it's far more than that. I mean, that's very simplistic. I don't think it's sexism at all in one way. It's of its time. Women were expected not to be in the sort of public arena so much. A lot of the science was done through networks of sort of friendships and familial networks, and it was of its time. I mean, my particular area is the late 19th century, and the women who were active in science then were well respected by the scientific community and by the men they collaborated. I mean, obviously there was a bit, there was sexism. I'd be silly to say there wasn't. But for the most part, I found that these women were of a certain class, and they, accepted the role of women. This was before women had the vote. They didn't feel so hard done by, although that slightly changed once the colleges for women opened up and educated more women in the natural sciences, for example, and women were coming through. And I think you got more rivalry between men or women, and a little bit more sexism then, with women not being allowed into lectures and so on.
Tilly, you might want to come in on this one. I was keen to just hear some of the breakthroughs that have been overlooked that were made by women scientists.
Well, I think the point that Claire made about women, not being in the archives and being invisible, is a really important one when you start trying to look at scientific history, recent scientific history, and by recent I mean the last 100 years or so. A simple point is, for example, in the Royal Society, which Claire was talking about, there is no major collection of papers from a woman scientist there, from a woman FRS, which is quite astonishing nowadays. When I started, I came into history of medicine from the lab. I'm a neuroscientist originally. And when I started reading about the history of my field and the history of modern medical sciences, it didn't represent the world I came from. When I read about the history of medicine, there weren't many women in it. Oh, there were a few nurses, but you could go through most histories of medicine or histories of science and learn about Marie Curie and Florence Nightingale and very little else. So I became really interested in this subject from looking at for the hidden voices, hidden people. But trying to find the hidden women is really quite difficult. And yes, the women are completely, well, not completely, again, like Claire, I don't want to get carried away. But sometimes the way that people publish, as she's pointed out, they get hidden. Often colleagues will acknowledge a woman who but isn't given credit for as authorship credit. And this gets, again, as a time of the sign of the times, the women didn't push themselves to the fore. If you come into more recent times, there was women like, I mean, one of my heroines, Ethel Bidwell. Now, I think very few people would have heard of Ethel Bidwell. Now, she is a person who discovered factor VIII, which was the first reliable treatment for haemophiliacs. An astonishing woman working in a lab in Oxford, beaving away, very, very modest. She died recently. I've talked with her. I've recorded interviews with Ethel. Superb contribution, very little known. So, you know, Ethel is just one example of a number of women whose contributions are overlooked and are difficult for historians now to unearth.
Do you think there is some responsibility or obligation on universities and institutions to try and do more to make these women more prominent? And if so, is there a perception that you need more role models to bring younger women into science?
Well, I think actually nowadays there is this scheme called Athena Swan, which is part of the Equality Challenge Unit, and that now, this Athena Swan Charter, is a formal commitment to advancing women's careers in science, technology, engineering, maths and medicine, you know, the so-called STEM subjects. And they actually provide particular levels of charter awards, bronze, silver and gold awards, to individual departments and schools and universities. And it's beginning to become obligatory for departments to hold these awards to be able to get awards, for example, various research council awards. So Athena Swan is making a big difference, I think. Not perhaps enough of a difference and not fast enough for some people, but it's extremely important.
Yeah, and I'd say another thing we need to do is sort of stop the way that we tend to talk about women in science as, say, heroines of science. This sort of makes them seem somehow unusual and special. And I think there's still a bit of a tension between femininity and science, and this kind of endorses this. I mean, there's so many women out there who weren't heroines. They were just, you know, people doing science and researching science like their male counterparts. And if we sort of turn them in some kind of sort of heroine goddess type figures, we're doing a sort of disservice, really, and we're not putting them up as role models because we're making them out to be somehow super women when they were just, well, in one sense, ordinary women.
Can I come back on that? As I did use the expression heroine for Ethel Bidwell, because I do think she is quite exceptional. And the point I was making in response to the question was, we don't know about the exceptional women, let alone, as you quite rightly say, Claire, you know, all the women who are, yes, the women who are going around contributing to science in everyday ways. And yes, in a way, it would be great when women in science is not an issue, when it's just so automatic that there is parity and equality. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Tilly, one of the sessions you're taking part in is entitled White Coats and No Trousers, and it looks at these experiences of women laboratory technicians. And, you know, these people, I mean, I've worked in a lab, and I know that the lab technicians, male and female, are very much sort of off the radar and rarely get credits. What are you going to focus on in that session?
As I was said earlier, when I became a historian and I looked around and the accounts I could read didn't reflect the world I came from in the lab, and in particular as technicians who were missing. That's how I learned to do my job. It was the technicians who had the continuity and the skills who told me all sorts of tricks and just how to be a good scientist. I tried to be a good scientist. And so I really became very interested in technicians. I'm writing a book about laboratory technicians. I've interviewed perhaps about 80 or 90 lab technicians. I got hundreds of hours of interviews. It was really, really difficult to find women technicians. Mm. It's hard enough to find technicians or retired technicians. Finding women technicians was even harder. And some of the women I found didn't want to be interviewed. They were very modest, very retiring. When they were interviewed, they didn't want to be quoted or cited. It has been incredibly difficult to find the women. So I'm looking at hidden people, looking at technicians, and then even further hidden people, looking at women technicians. It's interesting, the title, White Coats and No Trousers, comes from the National Institute of Medical Research, really. They had class distinctions in lab coats between their scientific staff, technical staff, maintenance staff. White coats for the scientists, brown coats for the technicians, and blue coats for the maintenance staff. But women, they were obviously a different class, so all women were allowed to wear white coats, even women technicians. But there was a dress code, and even in the coldest winter, women were not allowed to wear trousers. So that's where the title comes from. White coats and no trousers. Well, it gets people talking, so that's quite useful.
I presume that's a historic rule.
Oh, yes. That changed in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And the big person who made a change for that was Sir Peter Medawar, the Nobel laureate who became the director and threw away a lot of those stuffy old rules.
I was interested that you have a session looking at what's called the leaky pipe, and you have this interesting point that Nina Baker at Strathclyde University is making, where she says that even when the proportion of students in STEM subjects is similar to or higher than that of men, so even when you have more women than men at the student stage of their careers, by the time they get to tenured status, the percentage of women has started to decline, and when you get seriously professional, you're looking at about women are about 15% of the total. That to me suggests that it's not a lack of role models, maybe, that women, young women scientists are very interested and want to do science. It's just that they are not, they're hitting problems along the way. And I know this is a very well-trodden area. And she herself says that many of these barriers are familiar and the solutions are obvious. But if the barriers are familiar and the solutions obvious, what is the stumbling block? Why are these things not being sorted out?
I mean, I think there's, I mean, Tilly will know probably more than me on this, but I think there still is a culture in science with the kind of sort of workloads that don't fit in very well around a family. Also issues of when sort of women are in their childbearing age, that this is the time when they have to really consolidate their careers and apply for research funding and so on, which is so important these days. And I think the women just find it, you know, that there's not often the support mechanism there for them. Mm. And this seems a perennial problem, and you're right, it seems, why haven't we solved this yet? But it still seems to be a problem. But I think we need to have to look at the whole culture and structure of science.
Solutions have been suggested, though. It's not they are out there. I mean, Tilly, what do you see as the reason those things aren't implemented?
Well, I think a number of problems, often institutional problems. I mean, I think this is one of the areas that Athena Swan is really trying to address, particularly trying to get women into management and policy making levels, not just as role models, but actually as effective people bringing different perspectives to the top table. That I think even with the best will in the world, some organisations are really quite flummoxed as to what do they do. How do they actually, as Claire just said, you know, how do they manage this rather macho culture in some science labs and some disciplines where workloads are outrageously high, where tenure promotion are awarded on publications? How do you compensate women for taking breaks for child rearing, for example? These are important issues that Athena Swan is desperately trying to address, and is having some effect by, as I said earlier, having these charters that are now becoming obligatory for various research council funding. Mm-hmm. Some organisations, professional bodies, grant awarding bodies like the Wellcome Trust have, for example, created returning fellowships to help women back into the scientific labour force after a break. So there are efforts being made, but I think most women in science, and neither Clara nor I are practicing scientists. Mm. I think a lot of women in science think it's not going fast enough.
A huge thanks to Claire Jones and Tilly Tansey. For more information on the Revealing Lives conference taking place at the Royal Society in London on Thursday the 22nd and Friday the 23rd of May, just go to the Women in Science Network site, that is womeninscience.net. We'll have links to it on the blog for this podcast.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For any young woman aspiring to build a career in the sciences, there can be few better role models than Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn. Along with Carol Greider and Jack Szostak, she received the 2009 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for the co-discovery of the enzyme and chemical structure of telomeres, the vital tops and tails of our chromosomes. Also, Dr. Blackburn has worked in medical ethics and controversially in 2004 was dismissed from President Bush's Council on Bioethics. In November of last year, she gave the prestigious Schrödinger Lecture at Imperial College in London and spoke to their head of communications and public affairs, Natasha Martineau, about her life in science. Natasha started out by asking Dr. Blackburn about that morning in 2009 when she discovered she was a Nobel Prize winner.
Well, I was very surprised and very happy. I'd sort of known that something like this might happen. People had mentioned to me in the past that I had been nominated. But it's one of those things that, you know, well, what are the chances? And so there's nothing you can really do about it. So you sort of put it to one side. So I was very surprised when I got a phone call at the hour of something like nearly 2 o'clock in the morning, San Francisco time, and a Swedish voice told me the good news and then advised me to drink a cup of coffee because he said the press will be coming. Sure enough, they did very early in the morning. but it was very exciting and it was very heady for about 6 days. I realized when I finally sat down to a meal with a knife and a fork, I realized I hadn't sat down to eat for about 6 days. But, the prize itself is one thing, and it's a wonderful honor. But I think what it's doing is it is saying it's celebrating science, and I think that's something that I like about the prizes, because it puts science into a category that says yes, there is something to celebrate, and so it does it in this particular form.
Did it change your life in other ways, either scientifically or personally, since then?
Well, in some ways it's changed. In other ways, you know, being a scientist is an immensely sort of rooted thing. I mean, you know, science goes on. Your colleagues, you know, are still your wonderful colleagues. Science goes on. You know, I have to, compete for grants and publications, just like anything else. And this is very wonderfully grounding. It's good. In other ways, things have changed. I was always really too busy anyway. But what I had to start thinking about much more was, what do I think is going to be something I can contribute in a useful way? People also listen to you in ways that, is a little scary, because they suddenly assume that you've, got miraculous powers of insights, which, frankly, are no different from the ones you had before. But, that's another curious thing that you have to sort of mentally adjust to.
Your research has focused on the structures at the end of our chromosomes called telomeres. Can you tell us a bit about what they are and what they do that's so important?
Well, the telomeres, as you say, are at the ends of every chromosome, and they're made of DNA and associated proteins, and they form a kind of protective cap at the ends of the chromosome. So we always like this analogy, which is that it's a little bit like the aiglet or the protective tip at the ends of shoelaces. If you lose that or if it wears away, the shoelace end starts to fray. You start to have a shoelace that won't work properly. A little bit like that for the telomeres, where the shoelace is the chromosome, which of course carries genetic information and makes all of our cells and our bodies actually do the work that they're supposed to do.
And can you tell me a little bit about what your research has actually been looking at with the telomeres?
Well, the telomeres were known by people who looked under microscopes for years. And so cytogeneticists, as such people are called, they knew for many years that if you didn't have a proper tip on a chromosome, if it was lopped off by an accident or even an X-ray, then the end that was broken was very different. It was very unstable and the genetic material was compromised. But the natural ends of the chromosomes somehow sealed off the ends of chromosomes in some different way. But fast forward then to the 1970s when it became possible to analyze DNA. And so I got very interested in what was the DNA sequence at the ends of chromosomes, because, you know, what was there. And basically it was rather mysterious, because it wasn't coding for genes, but it was repeated sequences that grew and shrank. And we discovered that these are maintained in a very special way, and that maintenance is crucial for cells not to have their telomeres wear down or erode, because that's the natural tendency of the telomeric DNA. For various reasons, they will erode away with both time and as cells continue to divide.
And what implications does that have for us as we get older?
So that was the big question, because we knew this happened in cells, and if you didn't have maintenance of telomeres, the telomeres would eventually wear down and then the cells would begin to malfunction in various ways. And so the question was, over our, you know, 80 years of life expectancy that we have, you know, in many developed countries around the world, well, how does that all play out? Because what you see in the test tube, or what you see in a mouse or a fruit fly or a worm or something with a short lifespan, may not be the same as in us with our very long life expectancies. So the question was, what happens in humans? And so by various combinations of studies, it's turned out that telomeres do show signs of wearing down as we age. And furthermore, that is really starting to look related, probably causally in at least some ways, to the diseases of aging that account for a lot of the mortality in the elderly. So it's starting to look rather central, although of course it's not the only thing going on.
And what implications does that have for clinical approaches to patients with some of these diseases?
Well, it's very interesting, because the extreme situations where people had a mutation that was known to prevent them from maintaining telomeres clearly had, you know, dramatic diseases. And some of them resembled in a very premature way the diseases that are natural with aging, like certain kinds of cancers or the immune system wearing down, which happens with natural aging. And so over the years, piecing together the pieces of puzzles, it looks as though telomere shortening does look as if it contributes to the progression, perhaps even the onset, but certainly the progression of diseases of aging in ways that are not very straightforward and yet seem to be rather common to a lot of diseases of aging, because all the cells in our body have chromosomes and telomeres that wear down. And so if they're wearing down, as they seem to, somewhat in concert throughout the body, then that can account for diseases happening in different parts of the body, like the lungs or perhaps the immune system. So the question is, you know, now we know this, can we monitor, can we use that as useful information, as one kind of a sign of what's going on in the whole body, or can we even change that, and will that actually make any difference to the progression or even onset of diseases? But we've got a much better picture now that this really is going on in human lives and is at least partly underlying some aspects of these very common diseases of aging.
As a biological researcher yourself, can you tell me a little bit about how your work interacts with the work of clinicians and what you have to do with the actual medical treatments?
Yes. Well, I was trained and I was trained in Cambridge in England with Fred Sanger, very much on the world of DNA sequencing, DNA structure. I was in a molecular biology world, and then that world sort of grew into, you know, the much more complex world of cells. And then, of course, our bodies are made up of, you know, millions upon millions of cells, and how all those interact starts to get very, very complicated. So in a way, what I've enjoyed is clinicians have to look at the whole entity, the whole body, and sort of think about that as a whole. Of course, it breaks down into sub-diseases, but still, you have to now look at the integrated information. And of course, try and think very quantitatively about it, because when you do things quantitatively, you can now do science with things. And so I found it fascinating to interact with clinicians who have their discipline of clinical studies, which requires statistical analyses, certain sorts of safeguards and controls. And the challenges are very different from the ones that you have in the lab. But I think, you know, what brings science of various kinds together is thinking. You know, if the rigorous thinking goes into science, then the subject matter is one thing, but the rigorousness, hopefully, is what really will allow truths to get revealed. And so, so I found it fascinating. But we have to learn to speak each other's language. You know, so it's. Often a matter you really have to sit down and talk with your collaborators, and you can do a certain amount by email, but you do have to talk and make sure that they understand what you understand when you say certain words. Conversely, I'm sure I was so incredibly ignorant about clinical studies that, you know, I was amazed at their patience in indulging me and explaining so many things that I didn't know about clinical studies. But working with people who are expert and rigorous thinkers, I think, can be very profitable, even though fields are very different from each other.
Another dimension that I know you have worked in previous years is what happens to science when it moves into the realm of public policy. You sat on the US Council on Bioethics in 2002 to help advise the Bush administration on stem cell research. Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences on that panel?
Well, it was very interesting, because it was at a time when the whole question of evidence and how do you make decisions was under a lot of political scrutiny at the time, and that extended to areas of weapons of mass destruction, and it extended to areas of climate change and even areas of pollution. And there were sort of documented instances in those cases where there had been, you know, clearly sort of ideological or political kinds of overtones in how the messages were being conveyed. So here was an example of something where I, you know, knew fairly much what I was talking about, which was science and cell biology, and I felt I was a sort of seasoned old person who could, who would understand some of the complexities of the system, but also you have to be able to sort out what's good evidence, what are statements that are not so well based. So I thought this would be a contribution I could make, and it was very fascinating to be on a group of people where there were some very different views about how you think about information, how you come in with ideas of what science policy should be based on. So I just kept saying in my boring way, get the science right, because that's all I could do. And they got a bit tired of me and threw me off in the end for doing that, I think. Also, my views didn't coincide with those of the administration. So it was very interesting, though, because the public, interestingly enough, seemed to really care about this. And I think it was much more because of these other wider contexts than this perhaps one issue itself. I think it was in this larger context that a lot of interest was taken in this fact, because it was seen as rather representative of the idea that perhaps science evidence wasn't being taken into account when various aspects of science policy were being promulgated.
The role of scientific advice in policymaking in the UK has also had something of a bumpy ride, I think it's fair to say. How did your perhaps not wholly positive experiences affect your appetite for taking part in this kind of work?
Well, I think it's very good when we live in a sort of sheltered world of science, and we tend to think that a lot of the world will surely must think like us. And so it's actually very salutary to realize that a lot of the world looks upon questions of authority and, you know, worldview and so on in very different ways, which, you know, when you're embedded in a profession, even though you know the world exists around you, you're not so aware that people might not think in the same kind of way that I think, you know, we think is sort of rationally based and so forth. So it wasn't, no. So I think it's very important to take these questions on, fully recognizing that, yes, this is going to be the reality. The experience in some ways was very positive, because so many people really reached out in lots of ways and said, you know, yes, I'm very worried about this too.
In terms of focusing on what's scientifically important to you, can you tell me a bit about what you're working on these days?
Well, I have two very different kinds of things. On the one hand, I'm working very much on the basic questions of telomeres and the enzyme telomerase that we had discovered all these years ago, which is important for maintaining telomeres, but retains still some very mysterious aspects in terms of what it does in cells. You know, like everything in biology, the more you look, the more you find that's fascinating and unexpected. And then juxtaposing, in addition, our very kind of, sort of central focus on telomeres and their maintenance, juxtaposing that with clinical studies and trying to think very quantitatively about that, because you have to do that in these very complex things called human bodies. And so... we have both of those going on in the lab, which is fascinating because they inform each other. We've learned things. Humans have told us things when we quantitatively look at effects on telomeres and their maintenance and relate those to certain risk factors for disease and even disease states. And those in turn invite questions of a very basic kind of science nature. So the two feed on each other back and forth. So I really have a sort of somewhat schizophrenic existence, you know, talking, you know, with people who are studying 100,000 people and trying to understand, how all their telomere maintenance properties are related to their lives and their clinical and health aspects, to looking at single yeast cells in microfluidics devices. So both of these ways of approaching the same kind of question sort of feed on each other.
You mentioned working on sample sizes of hundreds of thousands of people. Does your work have implications for individual patients and personalised medicine, the sort that we're hearing a lot about these days?
Yes, I think very much so. I think there's two ways to do clinical studies. You know, doctors have done it for years. They look at the patient, and the patient is the story, the individual. And then if you want to understand, you know, principles and extract things, then looking at, well, it was actually only 100,000 people, which is still pretty good. Then you try and look at large numbers of people, because that lets you extract things where a lot of the, complexities and differences can kind of get evened out, and so then you can extract certain principles that way. But I think that what we're learning is that, certainly statistically speaking, we see clear relationships of telomere maintenance with things like disease risks and even is fairly clear mortality risks now. And that sort of information, of course, has informed, you know, how doctors treat cholesterol levels and so on. It's a number. And then the thing is, how do you use that for a patient? I suspect more and more what's going to happen is that such measures are going to get combined with others, because they get power when they're not used alone, because they're very statistical, right? But if you combine it with something else, it turns out the predictive power gets a lot higher. There's a great study from Texas, MD Anderson, and they showed that in patients with bladder cancer, actually, if they had depression, they were actually about 1.8 times more likely to die in the next few years. But if they had depression and short telomeres, they were now 3 times more likely to die. And their median survival went from 60 months if they had depression but longer telomeres to 30 months. This was median survival without the cancer coming back, but it was halved. You know, and so that told you, well, you know, if you had that information, you'd say, well, okay, now, I know this person's at a high risk. So that may modify how that patient would be treated. So I think those kinds of things, where quantitative information is combined with other clinical information, is really just starting to emerge as what perhaps will be helpful for, you know, what we call personalized medicine. But of course, that's what every clinician does. It's the individual patient in the end.
So the secret of eternal youth lies in our telomeres.
Well, no, not the secret. The secret probably to living out what seems to be probably a genetically determined lifespan. But the question is, if you live that in health or in, a lot of disability, and more, I think, people would say, well, what is interesting to them is their health span rather than, you know, living to Methuselah-like life. But most people would say, I'd rather live healthily for as much as my life as possible. Although I haven't met many people who are that interested in extending their lifespan ridiculously long. But, you know, what does seem realistic and important is how you can approach the maximum number of years which are not spent in, you know, frailty and disability and illness, which, you know, happens at the end of life. So can you compress that part as much as possible? So I don't think it's eternal youth. You know, some people say teenagers forever, this would not be good.
Professor Blackburn, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn there, and a huge thanks to the good folk at Imperial College London for that interview. That's all we have for you this week. From me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.